I signed the contract for this book 22 years ago. So it's been worth the wait, I hope.
So how did it come to pass that you would be a scholar of Jack London? Because you first published on him in 74.
Actually, my first book on London was 65. And I began publishing in the late 50s, early 60s on Jack London. But the first book was a volume in the brand new Harper Perennial Classic Series, Great Short Works of Jack London. That was my first, and that came out in 1965.
So how, and you've been with him ever since, attached at the hip.
I think my family would say so. I mean, he's lived with the family practically all their lives. In fact, I got hooked on Jack London when I was in the Navy back in 1952. A friend of mine, my best friend in college at SMU, took a course in the American novel and read Martin Eden. I'd never heard of it. He said, Earl, you need to read Martin Eden. It's very powerful. I said, well, who's it by? He said, Jack London. I said, never heard of it. Heard of The Sea Wolf and The Call of the Wild. He said, well, this is something you need to read. That was 1948. I had other interests, mostly extracurricular then. But when I was in the Navy, I was on a weekend pass from boot camp in Bainbridge, Maryland, in Manhattan downtown, browsing in a newsstand. Saw this 25-cent paperback of Martin Eden. I said, well, my buddy recommended it, so I'll take a look at it. I was absolutely captivated from the outset. I read it on the way back, on the bus back to the base. I was so taken with it, I kept my flashlight on in the bunk to finish it that night. And I said, if I ever go back for a PhD, I'm going to do it on Jack London. And 6 years later, I did that at the University of Wisconsin.
And when did you come to Centenary?
I came to Centenary in January 1955. I was assistant sales manager for Hager Company in Dallas. I'd taught at SMU. In fact, I taught phys ed before I taught English, before I went into the Navy. And I thought I'd try the business world, had a fine job with Hager and Dallas men's pants manufacturer. I tell folks the intellectual challenge of men's pants wore thin after about 6 weeks. It was a good job, but in January of 55, the chair of the English department at SMU, Dr. George Bond, called me one Saturday morning and said, Earl, you interested in getting back into teaching? I said, I surely am. He says, a little college over in Shreveport, looking for an instructor, and I'll put your name in. 3 weeks later, I was teaching at Centenary. That's January of 1955.
Tell me about the Jack London Museum in Shreveport. What is the Jack London Museum here?
Well, it's right next door
is
to
that,
us.
Is that right? Okay.
The Peters Building was erected to house the Jack London memorabilia and archives. That's a wonderful story there that would take quite a while to tell you, but I don't know how much time you've got here, but I can tell you that it originated with Don Webb, President Webb, back in 1988 or so. He went to Mr. Sam Peters at lunch one day. Mr. Peters had just retired, I think, from Coca-Cola, was on our board of trustees, also a very loyal Centenary alum. Dr. Webb says, Sam, we've got this Jack London scholar on campus. We need a place, a room in the library for him to do his research. There at the Shreveport Club, I think, Sam pulls out his checkbook, says, how much? Don says, I think $25,000 would do it. Sam writes him a check. Dr. Webb hadn't bothered to check with the librarian. They didn't have a spare room. Jim Volney, our librarian, was a little bit upset. I said, Jim, relax. I'm not going to move in on you. So Dr. Webb went back to Sam Peters. He said, Sam, what we really need for Earl is a building. Meanwhile, I had introduced Sam and his wife, Ann, as well as Don and Renee, to Milo Shepherd, Jack London's nephew, who managed the ranch and vineyards out in Glen Ellen. In fact, they had been out there visiting and what have you. So there was a connection, and Milo called Sam. He said, "Sam, you give the building, I'll give the memorabilia and archival materials to go inside it." And that was the origin of the Jack London Museum and Research Center, which is over there now. And when you have time, I'll be glad to give you a tour.
You know, you've said before that there's always so much more to say about Jack London, so much more to understand about this complex man. Is this biography your last word on Jack London?
I don't think there'll ever be a last word on Jack London, mine or anybody else's. I mean, I don't know what metaphor to use or whatever, but here I've been with him seriously for 60 years or so, and I still discover what qualities, themes, factors in his fiction that I'd not realized before. It's so rich. What people don't realize is how highly educated he was, even though self-educated. His works are rich with biblical allusions, classical allusions. He read voraciously. His own personal library, when he could afford the books, was over 15,000 volumes. It's just amazing. The man was a genius. And that's what a lot of the critics yet simply don't realize. And I make that point in my biography. He was also what we call a seeker. They've discovered in the last several years that in that lowest level, the most primitive area of the mammalian brain, there is another drive just as strong as those drives, such as the drive for food, fear, sex, and all that, sometimes overrides those other primitive drives. And that was certainly something that Jack had in an extraordinary degree. It's amazing the adventures he had and survived, as well as the fact that he produced over 50 books in a career lasting less than 20 years.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that. He lived a very short life, but such a prolific writer. And how do you produce so much so quickly? What was his discipline in writing so much and so well?
Absolutely incredible. He limited himself to 5 hours sleep a night. He wrote a minimum of 1,000 words a day, day in, day out, regardless of how he felt. Even when he was on that cruise, the Snark, even when they were almost running out of water and near dying of thirst out in the South Pacific because somebody had inadvertently left open the supply of the water tanks. Martin Johnson, who was with him, says Jack went below and wrote this story about a sailor who was dying of thirst. So he had this incredible genius, or I should say extraordinary genius, plus amazing self-discipline to drive himself. And of course, as you may know, that can be destructive as well as constructive. I think he drove himself so hard, that's one reason he died early.
And you suggest in your biography that he has been subject to some pretty ludicrous storylines about his personal life, addiction, womanizing. How has that impacted the legacy of Jack London and his literature?
It's had a major impact upon the biographies. That's one reason I decided that maybe I should try one. When I was asked by the editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux to do this, and I thought at the time, somebody needs to try to set the record straight, because he was responsible himself for some of this. I mean, he got so much publicity from what he did, but not the womanizing. I mean, now let me explain. In his early years, before he married his second wife, Charmin, he admitted to be a womanizer. He was incredibly handsome. Some people have compared his looks to Jack Kennedy or what have you. I think he was more handsome than John Kennedy was. But he was not merely his personal appearance, but he had some kind of charisma or magnetism. I've read any number of people who knew him said, when he came into a room, I mean, there was a certain aura about him that was just that he did not try to project. He wasn't at all pretentious. So as I say, the women were certainly after him. And for some years there in his younger years, he didn't resist. But after he married Charmian, I have no documentation that's reliable that he philandered. Now, I mean, some of the biographers like to dig up stuff, you know, about that and about his being a drug addict and a drunkard. He was, I think, an alcoholic, but he was not a drunkard, if I can make that distinction. That never interfered with his work, and he was one of these persons who could say, well, I can control all this. I drink when I like to. So he would stop for months sometimes. But Charmian, his wife, in her diaries, reveals the pattern there. He never abused her physically, but when he had too much drink, I think he also had a tendency toward what we call the bipolar disorder. And those things tend to aggravate each other or what have you. But he would become emotionally abusive at times, bullying her and what have you, especially in his later years when his health was deteriorating. Mm-hmm. But once again, the biographers haven't bothered to check out the facts because Jack himself has been such a popular figure, so marketable. Biographer after biographer has said, well, I'm going to step in and make a fast buck off Jack London. And that's what they've done for the most part. So I've tried. Obviously, my buck hadn't been a fast one, as you can tell from the time I signed the contract.
Yeah, what was challenging to you in writing this book? Was, or you know, 22 years is quite a bit of time. Was there a lot of research, or what were you really striving for in those decades of working on this piece?
To put it into one book. That was the major challenge. I had done virtually all the research over the past, 40 years, but to try to boil that down into a meaningful 500 pages, which is what my contract called for, was a major challenge. In fact, the first time I sent, I've been through six editors. The first one left without telling me where he was going, left me hanging, and the manuscript sort of gathered dust for a few years. When my friend Becky Palmer, who was our secretary, tracked it down, finally got me another editor, she took another couple of years and returned the manuscript, asking me to cut it about a third or a half. At that time, I thought, I'm just going to pull out, you know. I put too much into this. I'm going to find another publisher. My wife, Gail, said, you better sleep on that. So I decided to hang in there, and I'm glad I did. I think the book is better now, but I'm going back to what I told you earlier. It was a major challenge to take a lot of that out. Some of it, I did it very reluctantly. But ultimately, I think the book works.
What do you want people to understand about Jack London? Perhaps, you know, what is the takeaway for people who aren't well-read, who haven't immersed themselves in his work, in his life, like you have?
I want them to read Jack London's own works. I hope that if they read my book, they'll be prompted to begin reading some more of his works. Chances are most of them probably read The Call of the Wild. But there's so much more out there that is so rich. I don't know of any writer who has the extraordinary range in terms of ethnicity, in terms of geography, in terms of themes, and what have you. It's just absolutely amazing what's there. And I hope that the reader that you describe here will be somehow or other encouraged to get into the other stuff. Let me put a plug in. The best place to start is my portable Jack London, which is a compact collection of those various works.
There's this mantra for writers to write about what you know about. Do you feel Jack London really lived that? He wrote about the things he knew intimately?
This, I think, is something of a misconception on the part of the biographers and the critics. There's a lot of Jack London in his own work in terms of his own experience and his own philosophy. But I dare say that most of what he wrote was based upon what he read rather than what he experienced himself.
Personally.
For example, he spent a year in the Klondike, you know, the gold rush. He discovered very little gold himself. He spent most of that time listening to what those other Argonauts and miners were, their stories, and to understanding what was going on up there and converting those tales or rumors or whatever he heard into fiction. In fact, his most famous story, To Build a Fire, is based upon an actual episode of a man who froze out in the snow, and it's a haunting image of what actually happened because they discovered him. He was bent over the fire, of course, he was trying to make, bent over it, bowed over it. It looked as almost, he was frozen like a statue, looking as if he were praying there. And this is what Jack picked up to write the famous story, To Build a Fire.
Are you surprised in any way about how your biography has been received?
I have no modesty, false or genuine. I'm pleased. I'm delighted after all these years, to tell you the truth. I think in all honesty, I've got to admit I'm surprised to get the consistent positive reviews I've had so far. I feel blessed. That's how I feel.
And are you doing any book signings, book tours? What is your press schedule like on this?
Well, it's still in the making. I was signing books out at Barnes & Noble just this past Saturday. I've had a number of people come to me. In fact, I just got a book yesterday in the mail from one of my former students at Adrian College 50 years ago. I was at Adrian for 4 years in an administrative teaching post before I came back to Centenary. And he heard me on NPR and wrote and said, would you sign my book? So, yes, I've been signing books. The only official event was the one at Barnes & Noble. I don't know what else may be in store at this point.
Are you still writing every day?
Yes, I am. In fact, I just finished an article for the Huffington Post. I sent that off yesterday. I'm hoping that'll appear fairly soon. I've got any number of things working. In fact, I'm co-authoring the 7th edition of our Handbook of Critical Approaches with Lee Morgan, Wilfred Guerin, and our prize student and graduate, Gene Reisman, who's now at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And we're working on the 7th edition of this book, which has also been published in a half dozen foreign editions. I'm doing that, and I've done another book I'm hoping to rework, which is a kind of memoir celebrating that unique 5-year period in American cultural history between the Second World War and Korean War. Nobody has really celebrated that period, and I think it needs to be done before everybody's gone that knew about it. This happened the same time as Jack Kerouac's On the Road, but it's a very different book. It's what I consider a really accurate, honest view of America as it was in the late 1940s, including especially in the Midwest, and I think probably including Minnesota. I know I went through Oklahoma, Kansas, and north, up into the north, as far as Wyoming. Anyhow, that book I hope to wrap up in the next year or so.
And then may I ask what you wrote about for the Huffington Post? What did you write about for the
Call of the Wild? My title, America's Greatest World Novel. I said I'm not promoting it as America's greatest novel. I'd promote I'd choose Moby Dick. But no other novel has come close to The Call of the Wild in terms of the nearly 100 translations, thousands of editions, And I have a number in my personal library from abroad, and a number over in our museum. My greatest story, if I have time, I directed 4 NEH seminars, summer seminars for teachers. Each time I had 15 of the best teachers in this country, plus one from abroad who had applied to study Jack London under me. First was a woman from East Germany right after the wall came down. Second, a woman from the Philippines. Third, a young man from Albania, where Jack London's number one. The fourth I would never have guessed. He was a young man from the Congo. He told our group, "I was born in a jungle village. My father was killed when I was a boy, and I migrated into Brazzaville. I learned to read French and read The Call of the Wild. That book inspired me to survive." Isn't that a great story? Mm. I hope they put that in the Huffington Post. I put that in the article I sent in yesterday.
When do you write, or what's, you know, how do you go about your writing process? Where do you write here? Do you write at home?
No, I can't do it here. I'm surrounded by
distraction.
My whole house is full of Jack London. Now my wife says, "You got to clear this out." Anyhow, I write there in my own study, and my old schedule, when I could crank out the stuff so quickly, I would work from, say, about 9 or 10 at night to 1 or 2 in the morning when my wife and the children are in. Yeah, you may identify with this, when the kids are in bed. Now I can't function that late and still function the next day too well. So I work when I can. Usually I tend to wake up toward the evening. My clock is set that way. So I will, in fact, I will work this afternoon some on one of these projects. And probably... I try to get to bed now before midnight, but it's seldom I do it. If I get kind of wound up, I don't want to let go. So I don't have the kind of intense schedule that Jack London worked under, though for some years I did close to that when I was cranking out books. In 1994, I turned out 3 books in 1 year. I mean, they had been in the works. In fact, that's part of the story of the biography. I couldn't start to work on the biography till I fulfilled those contracts. So actually, I didn't start writing the biography until 1995. But anyhow, it's been a long road.
You described in the preface of your book, I believe, about discovering London at age 12, a little boy in Oklahoma, rural Oklahoma, and being liberated. Were you liberated by London?
Well, I explain in my preface there. I mean, here was a new world for me. I had a wonderful childhood in Tuskahoma. That was my birthplace. And I wouldn't compare myself necessarily to Huck Finn, but I could run in the woods and fish in the Kaimashi River, and my best friend was the son of a bootlegger. Now, the man, his father didn't make the stuff. He ran it in from Texas, but he was very wise in that he invested his money into cattle. So they had a cattle ranch, and my buddy and I rode horses and roped calves and what have you. Rode calves. We didn't ride any bulls, but it was that kind of life. So I was, you know, I was as happy as a boy could be, I thought, until I discovered Jack London. And here was another world that I hadn't found yet, even more exciting in many ways. So that was my initial discovery. I never heard of Jack London again, as I say, until I was a senior at SMU.
Finally, I want to ask you, does Jack London have an equal among American writers in your mind?
No question. No, there's nobody can touch him, not in what he does. Now, I don't think Herman Melville has an equal. I don't think Ernest Hemingway has an equal. I don't think Henry James has an equal. But each is sine qua non. There's nobody in Jack's league in the world who can touch him in terms of the extraordinary breadth of his vision and the works, the peoples he covers, and what have you, the different areas.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Is there anything we didn't touch on or anything else you'd like to add?
Well, this has been excellent. I mean, I congratulate you on your questions.
Oh, thanks.
I've had a number of reviews, and you've covered it very well.
Very good.
Offhand, I think the only thing I could do is repeat what I said earlier to your listeners. Start reading more Jack London.